understand, defend, and share your faith with confidence. This is Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
Thank you for joining us on Unapologetic. I'm Ruth Jackson. And before we hear from today's guest, just a quick reminder to visit premierunbelievable.com for more shows, articles, and resources. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. And if you enjoy listening to Unapologetic, then please do consider rating and reviewing it on your podcast platform. But now for today's show. Well, I am absolutely delighted to be joined today by Associate Professor Dr. Sarah Irving Stonebreaker, who is an Australian-based academic focusing on the history of Britain and the colonial world, particularly the intersection of religion, science, and politics. Sarah is the author of the award-winning Natural Science and the Origins of the British Empire, and she's got a very exciting upcoming book, Priests of History, Engaging with the Past in an Ahistoric Age. So we've talked about the fact that we live in an ahistoric age, and in some senses, this has definitely infiltrated into the church, hasn't it? What are some of the ways that we have seen this infiltrate into the church? Effectively, what are some of the results of ahistoricism in the church with a capital C, the worldwide church?
Yeah, I think, well, actually, in my book, I'm really dealing with a sort of contemporary Western phenomenon, because actually, when you look at places in sort of the global south where Christianity is growing, I think there's a whole different sort of kettle of fish, as it were. But in the kind of in the contemporary Western church, I think the way that I would kind of sum this up is that there is a kind of profound, almost a kind of spiritual malaise and sense of profound disconnection from the past, a kind of sense that Christians are kind of perhaps united horizontally by sharing certain beliefs, but there's not actually much understanding of the fact that we are part of a historical people, a people who God has saved in history, and who actually have an incredibly rich series of doctrines and practices, spiritual formation and intellectual formation that has actually been passed down through the generations. But for the most part, we tend to be largely ignorant of this. And so I think what ends up happening, so in the book, I actually outline five kind of sort of outworkings in the church that include, there's a kind of doctrinal drift away from Orthodox Christian teachings. There's a kind of focus on, I think, individualism and comfort, a kind of therapeutic sense. And that's a good one to kind of summarize now, because it's one that I think we can see quite easily. When we are sort of disconnected from the past, we actually don't understand or even know much about how Christians have lived historically, the kinds of lives that they've lived, how, for example, they may have served or engaged in practices of spiritual formation, self-denial, self-discipline, or whatever. And this makes us particularly vulnerable, I think, to embracing the cultural emphasis upon individualism and comfort, which means that there can be a kind of tendency to kind of see Christianity almost as a kind of cultural outworking of the idea that, well, it's a kind of this a feel-good kind of therapy, that Christianity is a kind of is another form of wellness almost. We kind of embrace that precisely because we're unable to see that historically this is not what the Christian life has been all about. That was made clear to me when a while ago I was having a discussion with a friend of mine who became a Christian at the age of 20, and he very soon after he became a Christian, he began to ask, well, what does this new life actually look like? I mean, and he meant actually in a really sort of practical level, what should I actually do to sort of, he was talking about, didn't use the word sort of intellectual formation or spiritual formation. The interesting thing is that the church he was a part of was really unable, it didn't know. I mean, other than to say, oh, just read your Bible and pray, which is fairly, well, it's good. That is correct. That is part of the story. But what it revealed is that historically, this is never how Christians would have just answered this question. And that actually what my friend was kind of yearning for was something of the kind of intellectual formation and practices of spiritual formation that actually the church has been using in many different, you know, ways and different denominations and so forth, but actually that the church has been using for centuries. But the interesting thing is we're completely ignorant of them. And so one of the things that became really striking to me as I was writing the book and obviously doing the historical research for it was just the degree of richness of spiritual practices, for example, in previous centuries. And one of the things that I was then able to talk to my new Christian friend about was the fact that, did you know that actually for centuries, for example, across Protestant denominations, was very normal and expected to use certain hours of the day to kind of engage in kind of routine practices of hourly prayer. And I talked about, well, so I'm part of the sort of historic Anglican tradition. And so the Book of Common Prayer, which of course dates back to Thomas Cranmer and the Protestant Reformation, this is something that Anglicans had been using like every day, common people, ordinary people have been using to actually structure their days around routine prayer. And when my friend heard that, he actually, his eyes lit up and he said, I actually had no idea that this is one of the things that Christians had done for centuries. And actually the practice, of course, I should add, of engaging in routine hours of prayer during the day when we can as a kind of spiritual discipline, of course, you know, dates back even earlier, of course, in the Reformation. But this, I think, really kind of encapsulates this kind of ahistoric age and how it's where it is kind of creeping into the church, because it illustrates the fact that there's this kind of profoundly helpful history here, rich with intellectual traditions and spiritual formation, which we really are kind of mainly ignorant of. And that ignorance means that we're actually unable to see the kind of cultural idols of, you know, sort of individualism and comfort and sort of seeing Christianity as self-help, because we don't actually see them for what they are, because it's all we know.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of those spiritual formation and practices, because you speak really beautifully in your book, Priest of History, about the night vigil, reading aloud at meal times, and meditation. I mean, why do you think these practices, and I suppose others, you've just picked three there, why are they important? And how do you think we practice these in a 21st century setting where things are not the way they used to be? And I guess from an outsider perspective, things might look a little bit strange if you start doing some of these things.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the funny thing about Christianity is that I actually think it ought to look strange, and it's probably a good thing for it to look strange. But the interesting thing is, so I sort of discovered these when I was reading about an Anglican community in a little village called Little Gidding, in the 17th century. And this community at Little Gidding were engaging in spiritual practices, which actually weren't unique to it, but it's a lovely, so they're actually common. These are not kind of, this is not an anomaly, as it were. But they engage in these kind of three spiritual practices that I outline and talk a little bit about in this chapter. The first one is this idea of the night vigil. And this is the idea that one might stay awake during the night for a certain number of hours. And the way it actually was practiced by this family, the Farrar family at Little Gidding, was to from the hours of 9 p.m. to 1 o'clock in the morning. But it's always clear, even when you read the manuscripts, that there's never any particular requirement that it be these hours or anything. What they would do is remain awake and hold a kind of vigil in which, often in pairs actually, they would read through the Psalms antiphonally, or they would sing hymns, or they would pray for a number of hours during the night. And I think there are all kinds of reasons why this is particularly important for them. And one of the really fascinating things about all of this is that this was actually part of the way that ordinary Christians were encouraged to structure their days in the 17th century. The Book of Common Prayer gives a list of feast days during the year. And the idea, and by the way, the idea about the Book of Common Prayer was that this was a sort of way of making the spiritual Christian life accessible and, of course, sort of uniform, something that's traditions that are shared, but accessible for ordinary people. And so the idea is that even in the Book of Common Prayer, there are certain feast days before which, and you can still read this if you have a 1662 Book of Common Prayer, before which the idea is this, the assumption is that you would hold a vigil or abstain or fast the day before. So this is actually really common practice. And actually, I think a really beautiful one too. And in terms, like Ruth, about your question of, well, is it something that could be helpful to us today? I think it could be. And I know of people who do a similar thing. And it doesn't have to be between the hours of 9 p.m. and 1 a.m. by any means. It can be sometimes, well, for example, one thing that my family have done on Easter morning is that we hold an Easter vigil where we get up before sunrise and read through. There are certain biblical passages that form the kind of the Easter readings, and they tell the entire kind of story. And then as you read through these readings together, we don't just do it as a family, by the way, we're able to invite other people from our sort of small group at church in, that you do this by candlelight. And so, but after that hour or two of reading through this, that kind of vigil is over, the sun has risen and it's Easter morning. So I think those kind of spiritual practices can be really helpful, particularly refreshing in a world in which our time, like so many, is just kind of reduced to a kind of resource. So that's the night vigil. Another one I talk about is kind of communally kind of reading aloud at mealtimes. This is another really fascinating thing that was practiced at Little Gidding in various ways and forms. But the basic idea behind it all was that there were sort of communal meals, not just the family, but extended family, members of the community. But that at every meal, an opportunity was taken for often a child, actually, or a young sort of younger member of the family to read. And it wasn't always the Bible. Often there were just kind of books that were seen to be edifying, books that were sort of incredibly illuminating. We know that they read excerpts of Fox's Book of Martyrs, for example. And so this too is a kind of practice which I think is radically countercultural for a number of reasons, not least because it turns the kind of meal into a spiritual exercise in which, you know, the purpose of this is to kind of gather together and to honor God. We so often in today's world are kind of in a very isolated, individualistic world of kind of distracting ourselves and perhaps sitting at the table with people who are on their devices. But actually what communal reading at mealtimes does is that it invites us into a sort of intellectual conversation and the ability to actually break bread together and talk about ideas and to engage with beauty as well. And I mentioned beauty there because one of the things that my family have tried to do is read books that we have quite young children. So we've read books at mealtimes, which are really, which engage, I think, with beauty as well and wonderful stories. And we find that is something which is incredibly kind of enriching and spiritually formative. And the third one was, Protestant meditation. This is really fascinating. In many ways, this is the traditional practice, the spiritual discipline that I think elicits the most kind of surprise in people, because for the most part today, when we talk about, even when I mention the word meditation, we probably think of the Eastern religions. But actually, historically, there is, in fact, a Protestant tradition of meditation. And again, it's another example of the degree of ahistoricism in the church that we actually don't know this kind of thing. And even when I sort of talk about the fact that this existed, people kind of raise an eyebrow, think it's a bit weird. But actually, in the 17th century, for example, the texts on Protestant meditation were written by authors who were very much mainstream. Joseph Hall, who was the Bishop of Norwich, was a kind of celebrated, when I say mainstream, I mean, they're not obscure authors. The Bishop of Norwich, and then even Richard Baxter, right, the renowned Puritan, was able to kind of celebrate and encourage others to read what Joseph Hall had written. And in fact, even the Puritans in early America wrote a lot about practices. I won't sort of go into what Protestant meditation is, other than to say that it is not contra the kind of classic caricature we might have of meditation of being emptying the mind. Of course, in Christian or Protestant in particular, meditation is to actually orient the mind toward God and to fill the mind with biblical truth instead. So it's a really fascinating spiritual practice. And I think that these kinds of things, where we find ourselves often in a culture today in which it can be particularly hard to use our time well, and in which we are so very much at the mercy of the way that cultural forces and employers and so forth demand that we use our time, these kind of spiritual practices, I think, can be incredibly enriching precisely because they are so countercultural.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
You're listening to Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation. You've already touched on this with your Easter vigil that you do as a family, but would you mind sharing a little bit? Because I was really struck when I was reading your book about some of the things that you've done with your family through embracing the church calendar and the daily office. Would you share some of those sort of practical things that you've done as a family? Because I guess when you think about these things, I've got a 2-year-old and I'm thinking, how on earth do I put into practice some of the things that you're talking about? But as you say, you've got 3 young children and you're doing this as a family, not just you on your own pursuing some of these practices.
Yes. Okay. Well, gosh, I do want to begin by saying that by no means do we do it but perfectly, or, well, you know, it is always a work in progress. But I guess that's the point of spiritual discipline. So I don't for one moment need to present this as if this is something that we do perfectly or anything. Look, I have to say that the daily office in the Book of Common Prayer we've found incredibly helpful. And so in the Book of Common Prayer, this is 1662 version, but the version we happen to use in our family is from the Anglican Church of North America. I should probably tell you what, sort of explain to people that what the daily office is. It's a series of kind of small liturgies, I suppose, of prayer throughout the day. And it combines biblical verses with prayer. And so one of the things that we've tried to do, and of course with Bible reading, and depending on how much time you have, you know, you might read a psalm as part of it, or you might not. And then when we have a lot of time in morning and evening prayer, which is what we try to do, when we have a lot of time, there's a psalm and then there's an Old Testament reading, which is a chapter. We just work through the Old Testament, and then there's a New Testament chapter as well. And then that's sort of part of it. And then you go back and there's a prayer of confession and so forth. But then there are ways of doing this in such that it doesn't that it takes less time, for example, when we're going to school. But we found that it can be really incredibly helpful, particularly I think when trying to bring up children and give them a sense. I mean, gosh, for all kinds of reasons, we could talk for a very long time about the kind of culture that that parents and children find themselves in today. But I think I guess we found it more helpful than ever to be able to have a way of kind of trying to structure our time during the day around prayer and Bible reading, and trying to do that in a way, I guess, that forms us and also kind of forms our kids. And I guess the part of the point is that it is a bit of a discipline and it is hard, but I think that is actually part of the point, because of course it mitigates. In that sense, it mitigates against our culture's sense that, you know, we just do things when we feel like it, because everything is about the sort of the feelings of the authentic self. So I just, you know, pray when I feel like it. I do what I want to do. But that's what our culture tells us. And that's a kind of idol of, you know, using Christianity as a kind of therapy. And there's also, of course, you should pray when you feel like it. And ideally, of course, we would hope that we always want to pray. But the reality is that we're sinners and this is not actually the reality. And so actually the nature of discipline, of forming ourselves and trying to use that prayer through the day, mainly it's just morning and evening prayer. And my husband does what's called compline with the kids, can be incredibly, we've just found it really, really helpful. And the funny thing is when we don't do it, we really miss it.
So how can history help us to use our time well? Because part of you doing some of this stuff was that you felt like you maybe weren't using your time as well as you could.
Yes. Yeah, this is really interesting because I think what understanding history and in particular, the way that Christians in the past have understood time and ordered and structured their days reveals to us is just the degree to which we now live in an age and a culture in which time is actually just a kind of resource. And it's something that kind of busyness is one of the most commonly expressed kind of frustrations of our age. Like you never meet anyone who's not busy, right? So time is a kind of victim of all of this. But what history enables us to do, I think, is to reveal to us that actually Christians haven't lived like this historically, and that actually in the past, Christians have drawn upon an incredibly rich series of ways of using their time, not just in the examples I gave about using prayer throughout the day, but also have used their time in terms of setting aside to set apart. This is the very idea that there might be a Sabbath or something which is holy or set apart, might be a time which is set apart to serve others, for example, or a time which is set apart to do certain things, perhaps to fast or to pray or to read the Bible. And so actually I think, in a nutshell, history reveals that this is the way that we think about time today was not actually the way that Christians have historically thought about time. And that in fact, if we learn about how many Christians in different communities across the world have engaged with time as a kind of a gift for God and attempted to kind of steward it well, we can actually use our time far better, redeem our time, as it were, today.
Sarah, just as we're coming to the end of this podcast, I guess if you could sum everything up, this is a huge question, so sorry about this in advance, but why does history matter? And I suppose significantly, how can we, who aren't like you professional historians, how can we be effective priests of history?
Yeah, that's such a good question. Look, history matters for the Christian because we have a God who acts in history. I mean, God's story about him revealing himself to humanity and coming to humanity in the form of Christ and coming again is actually a historical story. And so for Christians, we are saved by a God who acts in history, and we're actually, moreover, saved into a historical people. So a people who God has, a great cloud of witnesses, as it were, who God has called to him in the past and throughout time. And so that's sort of, I guess, the first reason. But the other reason is that biblically, we are told to understand the past, to teach our children about history, not only about sort of the history of God's people, but actually we're told to kind of use history well and teach it to our children. And I mean this not only in the sense that the biblical writers again and again tell God's people, don't forget you were, and we hear it in the New Testament too, don't we? And especially in Paul's letters, but you were in darkness. You were part of this particular people, but now you have been called out. God has created the new Israel. You are called back into history. But we're also, of course, called to teach that story and to teach history well. But I think the third reason is that history is, I think, part of the creation mandate. And what I mean by that is that when God creates humanity and gives Adam and Eve the responsibility of stewarding the garden, then of course there is the fall. But even after the fall, part of the responsibility of humanity is to actually tend and keep civilization and to spread the kind of light of civilization, rightly oriented toward God, across the world. And history is a fundamental part of what civilization is. And so actually tending and keeping the past, and this is why I mean, you know, when you say priestly work is tending and keeping the past. And so tending and keeping history, the past, is actually part of what it means to be a Christian and to spread the rightly ordered God-honoring civilization across the world. I think that that's something, and I suppose the last part of your question was, obviously, you know, I'm an academic historian, and the question is really, what about people who aren't academic historians? I think, well, in the book, it is actually written for a popular audience. And so what I'm trying to do there is to show ways in which actually non-academic historians, we are part of stories, all kinds of stories, and we are part of the kind of overarching story of God's people, and that there are ways that you can actually engage with history, not only the kind of broad intellectual tradition, the kind of long conversation, as C.S. Lewis might have put it, that is part of the history of culture and civilization, which of course includes non-Christian writers. I think it's entirely intended by God that we ought to engage with, make sense of, engage with Greek philosophy, with Roman philosophy and so forth. So I'm trying to show that actually there are ways to engage well with the past as a non-academic historian.
Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been so enlightening, and I'll make sure that there's a link where people can pre-order your fascinating book, Priests of History.
Oh, thanks very much, Ruth.
Thank you for listening to Unapologetic. I'm Ruth Jackson, and as always, you can find out more about our guests through the links with today's show. We would love to hear your feedback. Do drop us an email with your thoughts at unbelievable@premier.org.uk. or get in touch via social media. And don't forget, there are more shows, articles and resources at our website, premierunbelievable.com. You can also register there for the chance to win a free book. That's premierunbelievable.com. And if you enjoy listening to Unapologetic, please do consider rating and reviewing it. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.
You've been listening to Unapologetic. For more shows, resources and our newsletter, visit premierunbelievable.com.